This is Profiles in Risk. Hosted by Nick Lamparelli. Every week, we interview those who risk life, limb, fortunes, career, and reputation, and those who work behind the scenes who look to protect and enlighten us about risk. You can find the show notes and other insurance-related content at insnerds.com. That's insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to Profiles in Risk. I am your host, Nick Lamparelli. Today, I am pleased to introduce Lisa Miller. Lisa is our first guest who has a regulatory background. She is the CEO of Lisa Miller & Associates, a business development, government consulting, and public relations firm based in Florida. Lisa is the former Deputy Chief Financial Officer for the Florida Department of Financial Services and the Deputy Commissioner of the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation. Lisa, welcome to Profiles in Risk.
So excited to be on your show. Thank you.
We are excited too. As I mentioned before we hit the record button, you're the first person to come on to the show that has a regulatory background. We have a lot to go through. We actually had a wonderful chat beforehand, so I may cherry pick, so to speak, some of the stuff from that conversation into this one. But to kick it all off, I gave a description of you. I always try to allow our guests to have a description of themselves in their own words. So can you describe Lisa Miller? What activities and work do you do around the insurance ecosystem?
Thank you so much for that question. And one of the hallmarks of my work in the insurance industry is to make learning and being a part of it fun. Unfortunately, when people start talking about insurance, all your guests at a dinner party or all the folks that you're visiting with in a meeting want to run the other way. And so as I've grown up in this industry, I started back in 1988 as a regulator. And I have found that whenever you have a conversation about insurance, you cannot use words like PIF, policies in force. You can't use TIV, total insured value. You've got to talk about things that are meaningful to people. And so, you know, a typical week at Lisa Miller Associates involves my work with regulators who are trying to understand what the market's doing. I might interact with legislators who want to understand why people buy certain products or they don't. I might be talking to a consumer group about how they can be more engaged with their insurance company. And I might even be talking to the press who are fearful of mean, bad insurance companies and what they do to consumers. And I try to give them, you know, the side that we are here to keep our promises. So I spend a lot of time talking about it, educating those who are in the market who don't understand it, and try to take away the fear factor.
I love that description. Most, I think, for the folks that are in the insurance ecosystem, they fear the regulatory aspect of it. And so what you're describing as, you know, being a former regulator and now being on the other side as well, that there are necessary trade-offs, but there's a beneficial relationship there. They're really there to help each other. Could you talk about the stigma of, you know, for those that are in the insurance ecosystem now that have, oh, regulators are behaving in a certain way? Can you talk about that stigma of what is the regulator's job in essence?
You know, there's a balance. There are two kinds of regulators. There are dictatorial regulators, those who always say no, and those that want to make your life miserable as the regulated person or entity. And there are facilitative regulators. And I would like to believe that states are moving in the direction of being more facilitative, that this is not us against them. And if you come with regulators who have that dictatorial style, my best recommendation is that you probably try to move in another direction. Either try to get to others within that office to get who are facilitated to get them to help you manage some of the strict regulatory functions that can hamper a good business practice. And there is a stigma out there that regulation is overburdensome. In a lot of cases it is, but I think regulators can be very reasonable. If you take a case to them and let's say that you want to entertain a new product in the marketplace, don't go in to see a regulator without doing your homework. I mean, literally down to having a conversation with those at the grocery store about this new product, or more formally focus groups or market research, and why you're going to charge the rate you're going to charge. It's not all about the actuaries and the product specialists. It's about bringing real life examples to regulators who are real people too. I had a company that wanted to bring a boat. We have a lot of boats in Florida, a boat product to market. They couldn't understand why the regulator was having such a hard time with it. And I said, have you been to the boat show in Fort Lauderdale and talked to 50 boat suppliers or boat buyers about this product? Because imagine how powerful it would be to put in your filing that, you know, on this day in Fort Lauderdale, you spoke to 100 people about this product and here's what they said. So not everything you do with the regulators has to be us against them. Have a conversation. Bring the facts to the table, and you'll get treated fairly, in my humble opinion. If not, they can call me, and I'll help them.
Well, you're bringing up a very important point, because in my experience working on both the brokerage and the carrier side, and this goes beyond the regulators, this also dealt with just any outside firm, it was only give them what they ask for, nothing more. Do not open up a Pandora's box to anything else. Your approach sounds more collegial, for one, and it sounds like regulators are actually human beings, that you can persuade them if you have the right pitch and the right argument. Are regulators human beings?
Very good question. You know, 9 times out of 10, most regulators are making, on average, depending on the state, I think our average salary we have in our insurance department, it's called the Office of Insurance Regulation. We have about 300 employees. I'd say the average salary is in maybe the 40s, 45,000, maybe 50,000. They're doing the same work as many of the same people in insurance companies that might be making 75, 80, 100,000. So you have to, from that perspective, a lot of times I think that they're doing the Lord's work and they're in public service. And a lot of times they do it because they're either retired or they're just starting out. They buy groceries and they've got car payments and they've got challenges and, you know, aging parents and friends with cancer and everything else that we do. And so when you call a regulator, think about, you never know what happened to them the day before. Maybe their child, you know, was sick at kindergarten or whatever. And so they have the same challenges that we do with everyday life, but they've got a job to do. And the notion that we should only tell them what we think they should know is false. The more open and transparent you are, 9 times out of 10, and there may be a single instance where that may backfire, but in every situation that I've ever been in, when I take in clients to see regulators or help companies approach regulators, I put my regulator hat on and think, what questions are we going to get asked about this particular meeting? Oftentimes, I advise those that go in to see regulators to take a one-page sheet. Here's who we are. Here's how long we've been in business. Here's what we think we're able to do. Here's the mission of our company. Here's how many employees we have. Here's our community works in the, you know, in our cities, in our counties. You know, a fact sheet of who you are. And that can certainly break the ice when you walk in to see a regulator. So my advice is, the more transparency, the better. The more understanding that they are people too, the better. All the better outcome for you if you tell them everything and more.
Yeah. It almost sounds identical to, you know, in my experience, you know, trying to pitch a reinsurer to back your program. It almost sounds like the exact same thing. It's just, what are you doing? How are you doing it? Can you show us that, you know, the demand for the product exists? You know, why are you choosing these limits for, you know, it just, it's the same kind of breakdown, it seems.
It is. It's no different than in any other purchasing transaction. When you're buying a refrigerator, most of us pop online, go to Consumer Reports. We want to know everything about it. So the company that gives us all the information, good, bad, and the ugly, the more likely we're going to buy that refrigerator. And that brings up another point. If something bad is going on or you made a mistake, there are two schools of thought. Never tell the regulator or self-report. I am of the camp that you self-report. We overcharge people this much money. Here's how we plan to get it back to them. We're giving everybody a toaster in addition to the check we're going to send them, or we sent out the wrong forms, wrong policy forms. Here's how we fixed it. So you take in the issue and the crisis and how you solved it. So good, bad, ugly, whatever, your regulator is going to find out one way or the other, and you might as well tell them up front. Mm-hmm. The lawyers who advise insurance companies and those in the industry will probably disagree with me. They oftentimes think this is a precursor when you're that open with a regulator to a bad faith action or a class action. I certainly love my friends in the trial lawyer community, though I don't agree with them in a lot of instances. But they do look for opportunities to sanction or cause, you know, I call stress or sometimes frivolous suits against our regulated entities. But I think there's a way that you can be very transparent without subjecting yourself to some of the perils of a class action or other things going on.
I'm especially curious about pricing and how the regulators, you know, especially the admitted market in particular, where, you know, homeowners, auto, getting to what price insurer can charge. You did bring up something, oh, we, you know, what if we overcharged? How do we, you know, reimburse the customer? And it got me thinking of, I've never seen a regulator, I could be completely wrong here, but I've never seen a regulator tell an insurance company, you're charging too little. I've seen a lot of cases where a regulator told an insurance company, you're charging too much. And Carly, Tony, and myself have had this debate on this podcast several times. I almost feel like the pricing aspect is almost beyond the regulator now. They don't know what the price is. And I almost feel like it's in the regulator's best interest to keep prices as low as possible. But I think there's a trade-off to that. That exposes the insurance company to, you know, potential, you know, depletion of their surplus. What is your opinion about that? Have you ever seen an insurance regulator tell an insurance company they charge too little? But what do you think is the regulator's responsibility when it does come to rates and pricing?
Yes. As a matter of fact, last year, if you were to Google this, the Office of Insurance Regulation told three insurance companies they were charging too little. We have a situation in our state where certain water extraction companies and roofers they walk into a consumer's home, your pipe's busted or you have roof shingles blow off, and they'll ask you to sign a document called an assignment of benefit document.
Yep.
Where you are assigning all of your rights over to that vendor, and then that document becomes a license to steal. And the claims have been inflated to the point where our government-run insurance companies having to raise their rates every year because of the proliferation of these assignment documents being used as a tool in a court situation. Insurance companies often will say, when a claim comes in, I did a podcast recently with an 80-some-odd-year-old woman who had a roofer try to charge her insurance company $191,000.
Jeez.
A roof claim in a 22,000-square-foot home when the roof should have been $30,000. And the insurance company, of course, disputed it, and they threatened a lawsuit, which is the game. You get the assignment, they hire a lawyer in the dispute. The lawyer knows they're going to get attorney's fees from the plaintiff's side because we have some statutes on the books that allow them to do that. And so as these claims costs go up, rates need to go up. But unfortunately, our market is so competitive, insurance companies are trying to keep their rates down to be competitive. But the insurance commissioner told three companies last year, you're not charging enough. This assignment of benefits issue is explosive. It's costing us an entire rate shock, I guess you could say, and you need to charge more. So I believe that the regulators that see that and this actually happens more with appointed commissioners than elected commissioners, if you think about that. You have an elected commissioner, they're basically electable because they keep rates down.
Mm-hmm.
An appointed commissioner, they have a tendency to be more a student of the actuarial science behind rates, and you'll see Florida's commissioner is appointed, and he told them that these companies were charging too little. So a lot of that's a function of politics and the pricing. If you want to do business in several states, I'd look to see if the commissioner's elected or appointed, and that may make a difference in how you go into that state.
Yeah, yeah. How is the – you brought up that Florida is very competitive. I think from the outside, that's what it appears, that it is very competitive. what is the, Florida is one of the most intense insurance markets in the world. Everyone is exposed there pretty much. What's the state of the market in Florida, the insurance market?
Great question. We have 12 million auto insurance policies. We have 6 million property insurance policies. We have 20 million residents. So it kind of, the math works out. We have, let's just talk property. We have in our state, of those 6 million policies, the average premium is around $2,500. That includes wind. The market is made up of what we'll call Florida-based companies. About 60 of those write anywhere from 50 to 75,000 up to as much as 600,000 of those policies. Citizens Property Insurance Company, which is the government-run company, has about a 500,000 of those 6 million policies. The Florida-based companies are the were the answer post-Andrew to the large companies, State Farm, Nationwide, and Allstate not wanting to be here. And they, it's not necessarily sometimes they don't want to be here for hurricane risk. It's political risk. We had a governor back in 2005 that, you know, belittled insurance companies and wouldn't meet with insurance company CEOs. And, you know, one of them threatened to leave and he said, don't let the door hit you in the tail on the way out. And it was a very cantankerous time. Some companies, Florida-based, they're called smaller companies, but I like to think of them as almost like startups in a lot of ways. They started 05, 06, 07, and today they're strong, healthy, billion-plus dollar surplus companies. So we've organically grown our market, not relying on the national companies. They're great companies, the national companies are, but we know they don't want to be here, and frankly, we don't blame them. And, you know, you look at the time of 05, 06, State Farm had, what, 1.5 million policies of those 6 or 7 million, and now they're down to probably 300,000, maybe, I'm just guessing. State Farm was successful a few months ago in shielding their policy count from the public record, so we really don't know. They went to court and got that stopped. But every other company reports in their PIF, policies in force count, and so you can actually go online and look at the Office of Insurance Regulation and look at the companies and how many policies they're writing out. Of what this property market has done. We have come back from a devastating 04 and 05 storm season where I was a deputy commissioner at the time, 7-8 storms that devastated our state over, you know, over a million claims and billions of dollars in losses. And we've come a long way and we're still moving. We're migrating into the flood insurance space. There is a move in this country to reduce our reliance on flood insurance from the national government. And I believe that that's where we need to be heading. So we have a very robust property insurance market with this claims insanity of assignment of benefits and claims elevation that we hope to get a handle on with the legislature. It's been a few years since we've been trying. It's a huge fight with the trial lawyers pitted against the insurance industry. So the property market's strong and vibrant. Our auto market, unbelievable. Very, very, very competitive with, you know, Geico, Progressive, State Farm, Allstate, just going at it. Rates are going down, and it's pretty amazing to see what's happening. Even though some rates are going up in certain areas, Miami, South Florida, because of some of the fraud that's down there with people staging accidents and that kind of thing, very robust auto market. Our commercial market, again, competitive. I have a business owner's policy. I have a BOP. One of the agents tried to quote me a surplus lines policy. No offense to you. I'm an admitted market girl if I can get it, and I bought it on an admitted space because I asked for it. So our health insurance market, very reliant on the federal government, as you can imagine what's going on there. Life insurance and others going well. So doing business in Florida is a great thing, and don't be timid. Come on down.
Yeah, no, it almost seemed like after Irma that the market just shrugged it off. It was, and from the folks that I am close to that have either, they're either doing business in Florida, have some kind of relationship or stake, you know, surplus stake in Florida. It's, well, we modeled it and it's an expected event. You know, this is one of the things we were expecting. I think that's a big difference than like the Andrew days or the pre 2004, 2005 days, is that the technology is so ubiquitous that all of these companies know what can be expected, and Irma was expected. And so I think it would, today it would take something drastic, like two Cat 5s in a single year for the market to really recoil. What do you think?
You know, it's funny you ask that. On Monday in the legislature, let me back up a minute before I answer that question. In our state, we have a private reinsurance fund called the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. We also have what's called the Florida Insurance Guarantee Association, and I'm sure your listeners know what that is. That's for those that insurance companies that go down. We have a guarantee association, the guarantee plans you're going to be paying. And, you know, we also have Citizens Property Insurance, which is our, if you will, kind of governor, you know, to govern what happens whenever the market shrinks or tightens, it shrinks or expands. So with those three entities, our CAT fund, for example, is working diligently to shrink itself because it needs to shrink itself. It has $18 billion in it, and that $18 billion has been collected over 10 years. And fortunately, there is a bill in the Senate. Our legislature goes to March 9th, and that bill is working toward taking away some of the fees that we as homeowners are paying with the to the Hurricane Cat Fund. So my point is this. Yes, I believe that Hurricane Irma was a shrug, but it's because we have such a strong, vibrant market. And whenever someone talks about, oh my gosh, what happens if the big one hits? Right now, our state could have two 2004, 2005 storm seasons, and we would still have money in the bank in our Hurricane Cat Fund to pay for a third one. So the big one, if it's $50 billion or $100 billion that wrecks our state, all bets are off. This state is devastated. The legislature, Congress, the U.S. Senate is going to have to come in and help us. And we have our work cut out for us because we know the big one, big $100 billion storm is going to hit. But there's no way that we as a state could be any better than we are right now and any more prepared. But preparing for something like that, it's going to take a village, if that makes any sense. We are prepared as we possibly can be right now.
No, I mean, I had a year in review natural catastrophe podcast with a bunch of experts as well. And I think it was kind of understood that the carnage that occurred, so to speak, in Texas was different than in Florida. And it's because Florida is extremely well prepared for these types of things. You get a lot of events. It's happened so many times in the last 100 years. Texas, a little less so, a little less prepared. It kind of showed, right?
It really did.
Really
did. You know, I have worked diligently to build a bridge between the Division of Emergency Management and the insurance industry because they are inextricably tied. For example, after the storm, our adjusters need to get into the ravaged areas. So I have worked with our previous emergency manager, and I know our current one, his name was Brian Kuhn, wonderful man, wonderful technician, emergency management technician. We would have coffee once a week and talk about how we can work more closely together and how we can become partners so that when the big one hits or when the storm hits, he needs to know what we're doing. We need to know what they're doing. And I encourage each of you that are in this industry, that are adjusters, that are underwriters or claims people, take some time and go see your local emergency management professionals and understand what they do and take them, you know, probably can't take them to lunch, but, you know, have a cup of coffee with them or something and understand what they do so you'll know more about what they're doing because you too need to know when the storm comes, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. What can regulators do better? We're in this era of high tech, and I deal with regulators on quite quite a bit of things, and I told you I would bring this up in the agenda, but I am surplus lines, and man, do I do a lot of paperwork. There are situations where I get threats of fines because I didn't do any business in any state, and they still want me to file my taxes even though I did no business. But it's very paperwork intensive. I actually have to print something out, fill it out, get it notarized, scan it, and then send it back. What, in your opinion, what can regulators do better? Where can they go to do a better job, not only for the stakeholders, both the policyholders and the insurers and brokers that are doing business in their states?
I'll give you a real life example. If you're doing business, let's just say in Tennessee, and you wish they had a portal for you to put everything in and do it electronically, I suggest you make an appointment with the regulator. You show them a budget of what it would cost to create that portal because you're in the technology business. And then you go see a legislator and ask if you can work with them on a budget amendment to get the funding for the insurance department or whoever to get that portal going. It really isn't about the regulators when it comes to what I'll call frictional costs to do business in a state. It's about the people that are regulated to get together to help them. We in our state went to the legislature because we needed people to help us prosecute fraud. And we lobbied the legislature to give two fraud prosecutor positions in certain areas dealing with property insurance fraud. And we got them funded. So you can sit in your chair, you and your listeners, and I'm in that bucket too, and we can complain about pain in the tail regulations and paperwork, but it's up to us to pick up the gauntlet and go see our regulator and say, let me show you the day in the life, the surplus lines agent, and how much time it costs, and all the frictional costs, and all the time wasted. When you have you looked at Amazon, blah, 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 or whatever the technology is, and it would only cost $50,000, can I work with you on a budget request in your legislature to get that funded? Ever thought about that?
So what you're saying is we should be proactive. Go have a cup of coffee with your regulator. Walk them through. Help provide the solution for them.
Absolutely. Help provide the solution for them.
I like that.
And show them how simple it is. I'm almost 60 years old. You're in your 30s. It just takes a little bit of your generation and those listening to – go see the people that are doing this stuff in the trenches every day because they don't have time to listen to the latest podcast in technology about doing so-and-so. I was one. I know.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And you're very persuasive. I'm not in my 30s anymore, but I really appreciate that. It kind of made my heart melt a little bit. So, we're getting close towards the end of the podcast. I want to respect your time. I can never find any good books on insurance regulation. Do you know of any that exist for listeners that want to try to understand how the regulatory function actually works or behaves?
You know, you're making me laugh because you're talking about books in an era of where I bet you guys all have the...
I love books.
What's the little...
The Kindle?
Yes, thank you. There is a book called The Regulator's Introduction to the Insurance Industry. It's by Robert Kahn. You can get it as a Regulator's Introduction to the Insurance Industry. Okay, so you can understand how regulators think, and it's what's being taught to regulators. And I suggest you read it. It comes from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So imagine that. I read that book. I know that book because I know what's being taught to the regulators. Mm-hmm. So that when I go in, I can discuss with them, I saw in your regulatory handbook, blah, 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 blah. So I would suggest that you read what they're reading.
Okay. I will locate that book and put it in the show notes for the listeners. So outside of the regulatory function, personally, are there any books that have been influential, not only, you know, either personally or professionally?
You know, The Secret, that book, The Secret, wonderful book. I love elements of human nature and human interaction. I'm very interpersonal. And I cringe when I think about and see you know, your generation and those younger who are not interpersonal. Think about in the claims arena. I do a class, I'm working on it now, hope to get it finished by the summer, on bedside manner for claims adjusters. Because I come from a small town, and if you have a cup of coffee and you talk to somebody, you can pretty much solve anything. There's a book called Nickel and Dimed, which is another great book, and it's about how a housekeeper working in a hotel, things you can do for that housekeeper. You can put the do not disturb sign on the door so she doesn't have to clean your room every day. Little things mean so much to people. And, you know, so outside the insurance industry, I'm all about, you know, I do things for dog rescues. I believe that we as a society need to focus on the interpersonal and the human side, which could bleed into the regulatory side because they're humans too.
Yeah. Yeah. We do stress on this podcast, the soft skills. I think a lot of the listeners to this particular podcast are so focused on their career and which exams you have to take. And we try to stress in blog articles and in the podcast, hey, you need to be able to talk to people. You're not going to be able to conduct business by text message. There's email, there's picking up the phone. Picking up the phone solves so many problems. You can get the answer right then and there. You don't have to wait for someone to reply, but you're having coffee. I love that. I mean, my wife laughs at me, but I tell her all the time, there's nothing quite like selling or the business of selling when you're breaking bread. It calms the nerves. It just makes everyone relaxed. So, Lisa, how can people get in touch with you? And if they do, what can Lisa Miller and Associates do for them?
Thank you for that question. It's my privilege to do three primary things for my customers and my clients. First, in the regulatory space, I help them understand how regulators think. If you've got a form filing, a rate filing, a new product, a Form A, a new company, whatever it is you're trying to do, we work all 50 states. I've got a great team with me, and you know, we just love helping people get to the next level, whatever it is, grow, shrink, whatever it is they're interested in. Secondly, we love to help people with their messaging. Who are you? What are you trying to do? What is your footprint in the marketplace? What should that look like? How do you reach the right audiences to make that statement of what your company is and who you are and why you're great for business and why you're great for consumers? And the third thing I love to think of myself as a connector. If you tell me you need to understand how seniors think, then I'll connect you with the senior living facilities in any state. Or if you want to understand what makes parks and recreation liability so critical right now, we'll talk to parks and recreation department directors across the country. There's really no audience that I can't reach or don't know in my almost, 40 years of experience. I started when I was in my teens, and I love to connect my clients with solutions. You can reach me. I'm always got my cell phone with me. It's 850-528-9229, 850-528-9229. And, of course, my email is Lisa Miller, all one word, at lisamillerassociates.com. Lisa Miller at lisamillerassociates.com. Would love to hear from you.
Yep. And I will, in the show notes, I will connect your LinkedIn profile as well. Is that okay?
That'd be great.
Fantastic. Great conversation. My guest this week has been Lisa Miller of Lisa Miller and Associates. Wonderful. I hope our audience got a flavor that regulators are human indeed.
Thank you so much. And we are. And y'all have a great weekend and carry on. Anytime I can help, just let me know.
Fantastic.